SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races. Just a second here to catch my breath and regain composure. Marty made us made me laugh, and so did Blue. And we had a serious conversation with Tony. Obviously, we're going to have Steve Haskin join us, and Rich Migliori and Zoe Cadman are on the way here after they wrap up their edition on XBTV and the bullet drill. They'll talk about pretty much just simple exercise routines this morning with the track absolutely just underwater. There's no other way to say it. Yesterday, the track had kind of a heavy consistency to it, and the ceiling of it for the overnight rains today into today left it, you know, much more of a sloppy sealed appearance today. So the horses that galloped yesterday and today really got a feel for two different kinds of versions of the wet track here at Pimlico. And Steve Haskin over the years certainly has covered plenty of wet days. There's also days here when it can be 98 degrees. There's been all kinds. You know, it's not unusual. It is the spring and it's volatile. I did hear an interesting theory, Steve. Who was it last night that, not an old, but something of an old timer, that said if it's a wet derby, that chances are better that it'll be a wet weekend in Baltimore. That was their working theory, one of those old timer, and it's been kind of a day of old timey conversation. Good morning.
I can't remember a sloppy derby and a sloppy Preakness in the same year.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, I can't think of any. I mean, to me, when I think of the Preakness, it's either chance of thunderstorms and or thunderstorms to go with the chance of thunderstorms, or it's 95 degrees and it's sweltering. I don't remember any absolutely gorgeous spring days for the Preakness. It's either hot or it's muggy and chance of thunderstorms. And I mean, the last Preakness I covered was American Pharoah. I mean, the rain that I mean, you could just see that those clouds coming in, and you were hoping it would hold off, but you could see it wasn't. And the first thing I did was just run out in the parking lot and leave my sports jacket there, otherwise I know it was going to be ruined. And I mean, the rain that came down before that race was unbelievable. You know, when we were all huddled up in the paddock to watch the race, that's where I've been watching the race there for years, and now Baffert watches the race there every year. And I mean, when you look at the outriders coming in, I mean, the outriders were absolutely soaked. And I don't know if I ever told you, but that was one of the best lines I've ever heard. Was that year when his rain was coming in, and Jill was freaking out because American Pharoah had the rail, and we were watching on the TV monitor the NBC telecast, and they showed the rail, and it looked like a raging river. The water was flowing along the, and Jill, you know, all she kept saying was, "Oh, that poor horse, what's going to happen to him?" You know, and she talking about, you know, cancel the race. I mean, it really looked bad on TV. I mean, you could just see the, I don't know when that was filmed. I don't know if it was filmed like while it was pouring or if it was live. I don't know, but it looked extremely ominous. And Jill was like so upset, more for American Pharoah that, you know, he had a run in that. And, you know, Bob wasn't too happy either. And everybody's got, you know, this tension about this track. What's going to happen to it? Is it going to wash out? And that rail looked horrible. And out of all of this, Bodie asks Bob and Jill, I loved his perplexing problem. He asks them, he says, how are we going to get to the winner's circle? That totally freaked them out. They said, no, be quiet. Don't say that. Are you kidding? You know, that was his problem. How are we going to get to the winner's circle? I mean, Jill is dying over there. You know, and then on top of that, when she sees the early fractions in the race, and she says, oh, God, he's going too fast. And then when he went off and won by 7 or whatever it was, I mean, it's like she had just witnessed this, you know, the second coming of Man of War. She just thought, you know, this horse is just unbelievable what he was able to overcome. But, you know, when the race went off, the rail didn't look that bad. And he just skipped over, and he was just so far and away that by far tons the best. And Firing Line, unfortunately, yeah, he got screwed up at the start of the race and never ran a lick. And a lot of horse Dortmund that didn't handle it. So there really was nobody that handled the track, and he just skipped over it. But that was quite a scene. But you know, a lot of times, you know, at Pimlico for the Preakness, they always call for those chance of thunderstorms every year. And most of the time it doesn't come, and you just wait and you just watch these clouds. But like I remember when Smarty Jones, who won the Derby in the Slop, when he ran in the Preakness, oh my God, it had to be like 97 degrees or something like that, you know. And John Service was freaking out because it was so hot, and the horses had to run in that. And but it's always some kind of weird weather. But I can't remember the Derby and Preakness. I do remember in 2003, Preakness Day was horrible for Funnyside. I was there that year with Joan and Mandy, took the train down, and the weather was absolutely atrocious. I don't know if the track was listed as sloppy or muddy or good. Maybe it was
they called
good.
It good.
It was
good.
Bad the day before. But it was a wet track and a horrible day. And then, of course, in the Belmont Stakes, it was sloppy when Empire Maker won. But it's very rare that you get two legs of the Triple Crown that are sloppy. I mean, I certainly can't remember a Derby and Preakness being sloppy. I remember when I first started following racing, the Derby was never sloppy. In fact, it was every year it was absolutely gorgeous. I mean, it was beautiful every single year. And I think, you know, I remember the first really, really bad day was when Sunday Silence won. But that was a rarity. I mean, for some reason, the Derby weekend was always gorgeous. Now, you know, we get sloppy tracks. Even when it's not sloppy, it's still wet. People forget when American Pharoah won, that track was wet. Remember there was a big rain before that race? And last year, they're still calling that track Wet Fast. That was sloppy. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, that was a sloppy track last year.
Well, that was the strange. What was the strange chart reference? Sealed Fast or something? It was Sloppy Fast. It was some crazy. There was an unusual designation.
Well, they're calling it. They're still calling it. If you look it up right now, it'll still say Wet Fast, which is. It was not wet. It was sloppy. It was fast and it was sloppy, but it was not wet fast. It was sloppy fast. And that's the whole thing. You never know what kind of slop you're going to get.
Well, and that's what was interesting today.
You can get a type of track that's going to be sticky and tiring. And the thing about Pimlico has a tendency to, you know, it's a great drying track, and they've always done a good job with it. But it has a tendency to be very abrasive. If you get like a light, if you get a heavy rain, you know, it keeps its cushion and it's okay. But if you get like a steady drizzle all day, one of those misty drizzles, it really makes the track abrasive. And I remember it was 1992 actually, when Lily T was the big favorite in the race. God, those horses came back. I remember Sonny Hine had technology in there. Those horses came back and were just coughing up mud, and it was awful. I mean, that was really, really a bad track. So it's a different, you know, variables as far as, you know, what kind of slop you're going to get, whether it's going to be a muddy, sloppy, abrasive. You just never know. But certainly looks like it's going to be a lot of rain heading into the Preakness, that's for sure.
Now, right now, it is still raining again. I was up at 4, Steve. It was teeming rain. Then it seemed to pause. And I thought, okay, we're going to get a break. Then an hour later again, and I mean, virtually hourly, there's like a downpour. Right now, it's like a light, steady rain. In terms of how you think Baffert, and we just had this conversation with Marty McGee, how he approaches this and the way they lined up, particularly with Quip on the rail, with Diamond King in the 4 and Good Magic in the 5, how do you think Mike Smith and Baffert want to approach this? The gates open.
Well, basically they would love to go to the front, but I don't know if they're going to be able to now with Quip in there. You know, Quip is, you know, he's sort of an oddity where you have a horse going against a Derby winner who has the same ownership. And it's not like Justify has two owners and Quip has 4, so you have to run for the other two owners because, you know, you can't deprive them of running in it. It's the opposite here. Here you got 4 owners on Justify and 2 owners on Quip, so they could easily have just kept him out of the race. But, you know, as Elliot Walden said on your show, they didn't want to manipulate the Triple Crown, and he says if Quip beats Justify, then Justify most likely wouldn't have won the Belmont anyway. But, you know, I've seen some crazy things happen in the Preakness. I wasn't around, but in 1931, Green Tree Stable had 20 grand to win the Derby easily by 4 lengths, and in the Preakness, they had a horse named Surfboard that they ran as an entry mate with him. And Surfboard had run in the Derby, and he wasn't even a rabbit. He had no speed at all. And he ran in the Derby and just ran around the racetrack. And for some reason, they decided to run him in the Preakness. And if you look at the footnotes of the race at the quarter pole, or if you ever get to see an old clip of it, 20 grand is making a big move on the inside and gets completely stopped by Surfboard. I mean, totally stopped, and he's got to pull to the outside, and then start, and then he's flying in the stretch, and is closing in and just misses catching the winner, who winds up finishing second to a horse appropriately named Mate. And then he comes back in the Belmont. He winds up facing 2 horses in the Belmont and wins by 10 lengths. So if ever a horse would have and should have been a Triple Crown winner, it was 20 grand. And he was not, because he got bothered badly by his own stablemate in the Preakness. Yep. You know, people say, oh, well, can Quip be justified? Well, let's just hope Quip doesn't do anything, you know, else. And, I mean, maybe if he beats Justified, then fine, he deserves it. Well, you know, you just got to hope he doesn't do anything. They have basically the same running style. I think, ideally, Mike Smith would just love to go to the lead, you know, and not get any dirt kicked in his face, not have to worry about putting horses away. But putting, you know, the way I see it, look, with Quip breaking from the rail, to me, they have to go to the lead or be right there. And Mike Smith can be able to just sit off of him. Now, the difference is that putting Quip away is not going to be the same as putting Promises Fulfilled away going a mile and a quarter. Quip's a very good horse. But the thing about Justify is that, from what I've seen at his 4 races, his strength is sort of like skip away. You know, people think that horses have to win races in the last quarter of a mile. But skip away could go a mile and a quarter race and go 22, 45, 109. And he wasn't going to come home in some absurdly fast time. But at that point, he will have put everybody away. He just ran his opponents into the ground Because listen, when they go that fast, they're not gonna. If they're anywhere near him, they're not gonna be able to come home. Now, if you look at this race, he could possibly, with the exception of Lone Sailor, who's a comfy hind horse, Justify could easily just run everybody into the ground. Anybody who's anywhere near him in the race, he's just better than everybody. So, to me, the way I look at this as a jockey's race is Jose Ortiz on Good Magic. Because if I was him, I might have a tendency to just take him back a little bit. Because Justify, listen, if he's going to get beat, he's going to outrun these horses. He's just faster than them. But if you're going to beat him, you got to hope that some of these other horses stick with him long enough and maybe soften him up a little bit. So you've only got 8 horses in here. And if I was on Good Magic, I might want to have him back in 6th or 7th. Not that far off the lead, but, the horse has shown that he can come from off the pace. He did come from 5th in the Bluegrass Stakes. And, when he ran into Champagne, he came from 6th. So you can put him anywhere. But I don't know if you want to have him tangle with Justify and everybody else get caught up in that pace. Because, like I said, if Justify puts all those horses away, you would think he's going to put Good Magic away as well. Now, we'll see what happens. We saw what happened last year with Always Dreaming when they decided to just go at it right from the start with Classic Empire and not let Always Dreaming get a lead. And Classic Empire put Always Dreaming away just as he was put away in the Ali Sheba. But Classic Empire was a very good horse, but Always Dreaming was a very good horse, but he's no Justify. So I think putting him away is not going to be easy, and that's the way he could win this race. He could put everybody, like I said, away at the same time. So if I was a rider of Good Magic, I might tend to just take a shot and just make a run at him, and hopefully the other horses. But like I said, Quip is not a bad horse. Sporting Chance, I think, is going to run a good race. Diamond King's not a bad horse. Tenfold is getting good. Bravazo ran a good race in the Derby. These horses, I certainly don't think they can beat Justify, but they're not going to quit. I mean, they're going to be around for a while, and if they can stick around long enough, then maybe Good Magic can come late. Because, like I said, there's no other comfy hind horses. Lone Sail is the only. He's only come from behind horse. He's going to be running last in the race.
And I see it similarly. I just knowing in retrospect, going back to American Pharoah and Baffert, I asked them, I remember asking him, had the rain not come, was there a chance that you would, let him settle and then work your way outside? And he said, no. He said, even if the rain hadn't come, we were going to the lead. And it that's always sticks in my head in these circumstances with Baffert, that he rather than, take any chances, just put yourself in the position, not to be compromised. And, it's funny. I can't remember now if Blue said it on air or if he said it to me off air, but he said what he respects so much about Baffert, and certainly when it comes to this horse, ending a long stretch of unraced 2-year-olds not succeeding in the Derby. He said it all gets back to the bottom that he puts in these horses and those 7 furlong breezes and the gallop out, Steve. And don't you think, that's when he's got a horse like this that can control the pace, he's relying on, even though he was unraced at 2, he's relying on that bottom that he puts in with those long gallop outs and extended works.
Baffert had no reservations about sending that horse in without a race at 2 or having only 3 starts. because he'll be the first to tell you, by the way, that he really gets – the one thing about him is that when his horses do get to the races, they are dead fit. And if, like you said, if you watch his horses work, they don't start running until after the wire, because he always works his horses, you know, after the wire. So if he works five furlongs, he'll always break off at the five and a half, and they'll be doing most of their running at 16th of a mile past the wire, and then they just keep galloping out. And it's old-fashioned type of training when horses would work long and fast. You know, you'd look at somebody like Alan Jerkins, and Alan Jerkins could never understand. And he'd always say, well, you know, I must be wrong because I don't win any of these classics. He says, but I don't understand why you'd want to work a horse a half a mile if he's going a mile and a half. You know, if Alan goes a mile and a half, he's going to work a horse a mile and a half or a mile and a quarter. You know, that was his style of training. Charlie Whittingham was huge on mile works. He used to give his horses mile works all the time. Everybody has their own style of training. The one thing about what Whittingham would do is that if his horses ran, he'd always bring them right back with a three-furlong blowout and then start building them back up again. And then, but if you look at a lot of his top horses, you'll always see that 136, 137 mile work. And Baffert trains the same way. And it's interesting, too, because you would think, you know, with his quarter horse background, you know, you look at it and say, well, you know, he trains for speed. But those quarter horses have to be really fit, and they have to know how to come out of the gate. And if you look at Baffert and Lucas, two former quarter horse trainers, their horses are always dead fit. That's why Lucas has pulled off so many of these, you know, crazy oxbows and commendables and, you know, races that that you wouldn't think he was going to win. You talk about Lucas, by the way, even though he didn't finish second in the race, you know, Lucas sort of did what Windstar is doing here, except that it was the same trainer and different owners. But remember when he won the Derby with Thunder Gulch?
Sure.
And came back, and then Timber Country beat Thunder Gulch in the Preakness, and then he missed the Belmont, and Thunder Gulch won the Belmont. The only difference is you had different ownerships there. And fortunately, I guess if you look at it, Thunder Gulch did not run second in the Preakness. He just got beat by a local horse named Oliver's Twist, I think it was his name. So he ran third in the Preakness. But, you know, if you have different owners, there's nothing you can do. You have to run against them. But obviously the big question is going to be, if Justify wins, what is Windstar going to do with Audible?
Right.
I would tend to doubt that they would run him. I mean, if you got a chance at a Triple Crown, you got a really good horse, you tell Todd Pletcher, look, you want to go win the Travers, go in the Haskell or the Travers or something. We got a shot to win, though. I'm not going to beat myself in the Triple Crown. But I don't know if they're thinking that way or not. They may be thinking the same way they're thinking with Quip. But I would tend to think that they would pass the race. And you know, it's not like you're depriving Pletcher of running. He's going to have Vino Rosso most likely in the Belmont. So he's still going to have a pretty good horse running in there. So
I got that sense, too. That part of it, I don't even think about. You reference the 95, you know, the Thunder Gulch, what happened there with Timber Country, and I want to say Oliver's Twist between them.
Yeah, Thunder Gulch was on the rail. Oliver's Twist was on the outside, and Timber Country came up on the outside of both of them. And Timber Country was going to be the huge, huge favorite in the Belmont Stakes. He got sick right before the race. And then Thunder Gulch wound up winning. He beat a Zito horse. I think it was Star Standard, I believe it was. And it was a very, if I remember correctly, I think it was a very slow Belmont that year, 230-something or other.
We're going to, Steve, Rich Migliori and Zoe are going to come by in a little bit. And before we do that, I do want to get you to follow up on a couple of other things that came up already this week. And that included Alan Foreman yesterday. And Alan, who I didn't realize his involvement in racing got underway as legal counsel to the stewards in the Codex Genuine Risk hearing.
And, I know, I read that. I saw that. That was pretty wild. I didn't realize that either.
We've actually got audio that Casey and I, it's been such a crazy morning with between Blue's visit and Marty McGee live and then Tony. We talked about the jock issues, but you know, we had audio from the Codex Genuine Risk Preakness in 1980. What were your impressions at the time, and how have you viewed it subsequently?
Well, I look at it this way, and I've always maintained, and I know I'm in the minority, that a Codex should not have come down. He was going to win that race. I don't care if we did go wide, but I remember watching, and the ABC film and the track film were like totally different angles, and while one of them looked as if he came out into her, I saw the other one. There was definitely never any contact between them. Was Cordero, you know, race riding? Yeah. Did he take it to the extreme? Yes. But in a race like the Preakness Stakes, in a Triple Crown race, when there's no contact, and he did wind up drawing off to win by four lengths, running one of the fastest Preaknesses. I think he went like 154-1 or something like that. It was one of the fastest Preaknesses run. And Codex was a very, very good. People forget, you know, he won the San Anita Derby and the Hollywood Derby. And there was a screw-up with his nomination, so they couldn't run him in the Kentucky Derby. But he was a very good horse, and he got hurt in the Belmont. We never saw him again. But I just think he was by far the best horse that day. And I my opinion is, from watching all the different angles, that he never should have come down. But I'll tell you, Cordero took a lot of abuse. I mean, he got death threats. I mean, you know, because, you know, a lot of it, because it was a filly.
Exactly.
And people were outraged over what he did. You know, listen, in those days, it was called race riding. If it was any other race, nobody would pay that much attention to it. But did he come out farther than he should have? Yeah, he did come out quite a bit. And you know, I guess if you can call it herding on the turn, you know, normally you think of
that's
herding,
what it is. It was textbook herding.
Yeah, but I'm just, but the thing is that a lot of times horses herd other horses, and they don't get taken down for it.
As long as there's no contact. Well, that's what I don't know if you saw the link I put up to the there's a 48-minute telecast from the from ABC and the race starts at about minute 31. And after the race, Jim McKay immediately, I mean, seconds after the gallop out, he immediately says, we're going to have to see if there's going to be an objection here. And
oh,
he
sure.
stays.
You knew there was going to be an objection.
And then that's the follow-up, and there's a good 10 minutes. And Cosell and Arcaro have opinions, and they very quickly go up to Dave Johnson, who interviews Fred Caldwell, the head steward, and you can tell that Fred wasn't all that comfortable in front of the microphone explaining the non-call. But it's a tremendous snapshot of of the immediate aftermath and how things unfolded. It's to me, it's like a time capsule. Obviously, it's invaluable.
Yeah, but people, even the Daily Racing Forum, which never took any kind of editorial stance back then, even they came out with an editorial condemning Cordero. I mean, Cordero, you ask Cordero, if you talk to him about it, he'll tell you. Well, the abuse he took afterwards and the threats that he got. I mean, it was just it was amazing. And I remember when they had the hearing, when the Firestones appealed the decision. I mean, it was It was a very, very heated, controversial incident. It really was. You know, and it all depends on how you look at it. If you look at it as far as did it cost her the race, you can come up with your own opinion. My opinion was that he was the best horse. He just drew off easily from her. If she had stayed with him and got beat a neck or a half a length or something like that, then maybe you could say that it might have cost her. But, you know, it's not like a bumping incident where you hamper another horse. By him coming out that far, he was hampering himself. They both wound up almost in the same path.
That's a great point.
Home, as long as there was no contact, like I said, if you look at the ABC film, if you look at, it looks like that there might be some contact.
Yes, and that's what they were,
film,
that's what they were looking at.
Absolutely no contact made.
Well, and that was brought up yesterday with the Alan Foreman's visit, and Alan said, you know, the film patrol, when that was available from behind, it became obvious that there wasn't the contact. But it's interesting. I got to also, Steve, let's also do this because curiously, May 17th today is the specific anniversary of Codex Genuine Risk, but also the one controversy that is way less discussed, and it's one of your favorites, Majestic Prince in Arts and Letters.
That should have been a disqualification.
Nobody talks about it.
Nobody talks about that.
Right?
Nobody talks about it. Majestic Prince wiped him out early going into that turn and really hampered him. Arts and Letters had to come from way out of it. And he didn't want to come from that far out of it. And I still thought Arts and Letters was going to beat him because, you know, Baeza had Arts and Letters way out in the middle of the racetrack. You know, to keep away, because Majestic Prince, you know, you could see how game he was in the Derby, because he turned back, you know, to the challenges. Arts and Letters was on his inside, and then Dyke came up on his outside, and he really dug in, and he's a horse that a lot of people didn't think wanted to go a mile and a quarter. So in this race, Baeza kept him way out in the middle of the racetrack, and then in the last 16th of a mile, he brought him in to show him, and Arts and Letters couldn't get by him. He only got beat like a half a length, but it definitely cost him valuable position going into that turn. Arthur Letters was right there, and you could see that Baeza's strategy was to dog Majestic Prince to stay with him. And when Majestic Prince came in and just, you know, just took him out of the race, and Arthur Letters wound up way at the back of the pack and had to make up a lot of ground. And, you know, that's not the way he wanted to run. So I thought that warranted a disqualification, but I knew that everyone can take him down because it was the Preakness and it was the Derby winner. Yeah, you can take down the Derby winner in the Preakness. So, you know, that of course set up the big controversy in the Belmont Stakes. You know, people forget that. People don't realize, by the way, that after getting beat a neck in the Derby and a half a length in the Preakness, two gut wrenches, Elliot Birch runs Arts and Letters back in the Met Mile,
right,
against No Double and the two-year-old and the former two-year-old champ Vitriolic was making his comeback from Phipps, and Promise was in the race. You know Frank Wiley, and Arts and Letters came from and Baeza couldn't ride him that day, but Baeza had a commitment to ride Vitriolic for Phipps, so Jean Cougay rode Arts and Letters. And he just put it in, and he was getting a ton of weight. He was getting like 15, 16, something like that, 15 pounds or so. Back in those days, there was a huge weight between the three-year-olds and the older horses. And Arts and Letters just blew by everybody and won in 134, and everybody started latching onto him. And then I remember when they came, there was a big headline, and it said Majestic Prince, might not run in the Belmont Stakes. Johnny Longden just did not like the way he come out of the race and didn't like the way he was doing. Frank McMahon overruled him. And then there was a controversy of Hartax Wright. You know, the pace was agonizingly slow, and Arts and Letters was just a superior horse going a mile and a half and, you know, set ridiculous slow fractions. It came home in like 24 flat. It went on to be a Hall of Fame horse. You know, he turned out to be a great horse. But that Preakness, was very frustrating if you're an Arson Letters fan, which I was, because I thought Majestic Prince, sure, if it was any other race, he definitely should have come down, but I just knew that, you know, they weren't going to take the Derby winner down in the Preakness for an incident that happened in the first turn.
Steve, I'll give you one other interesting side note from this May 17th date, historically, for Preaknesses. Uniquely, it is the date that the Preakness produced California Chrome, Big Brown, Funny Side, Silver Charm, Majestic Prince, and Tim Tam.
Wow, really?
All six,
all
obviously.
All try for the Triple Crown.
How about that?
Wow,
all came out of May 17th.
That's a great stat.
Isn't that strange?
Wow.
We go where others fear to tread.
So does that mean Justify will win the Preakness and then lose the Belmont?
Well, no, but it's the this year's Preakness isn't May 17th. Today's May 17th.
Oh, today's May. Oh, that's right. Okay. Right, okay.
We'll reference.
Yeah, that is pretty wild.
It's very strange. I just, you know, because I've been doing this, you know, did this in Louisville and I've been doing it here this week too, and because it's just, you unearth so many interesting things. Silver Charm, for instance. I didn't realize it. I didn't notice it until today. I'd forgotten, maybe. He was third choice.
In the Preakness?
Yeah.
Third choice, really?
Yes.
Well, I figured Captain Bodgett was the favorite, right?
And Freehouse. Freehouse was second choice. Yeah.
You want me to tell you something, by the way? All three of those horses that were in the photo finish, by the way, neither of them should have won that race. The best horse in that race was finished fourth.
Touch Gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of the most amazing losing races I've ever seen in my life. I mean, I've never seen a horse stumble so badly at the start where his nose hit the dirt and kicked up dirt. It actually hit hard against it. And obviously we know what happened because he grabbed the quarter and turned into a absolutely horrific quarter crack on there. And he got stopped like three times in that race. He got stopped on the backstretch where he totally lost position. He got crushed by Freehouse coming into the, trying to get through on the rail. He had to stop. He had absolutely nowhere to go. I mean, it was an unbelievable race after stumbling like that. And he finishes fourth. He got beat, a length and three quarters or whatever it was. I mean, he's right there. And if you saw what that horse's foot looked like, because I saw it before the Belmont Stakes, I mean, he had torn the laminae off of there. His foot was completely ripped apart. And I won't forget Dave Hoffman's worked him seven furlongs, and he was up there. And Dave Hoffman's like, you know, he was like totally lost at Belmont. And they had just had some rain, so it tightened up the track. So I was up there with him. Nobody was up there. He was worked Touch Gold, and I asked him, I said, well, what do you think Touch Gold's, you know, what are you looking for? He says, oh, I'm not looking for anything, you know. If he works in 129, that'll be fine. Even 130 is fine. I said, Dave, I hate to tell you this. There was absolutely no way on this racetrack that horse was working 129 or 130. And Dave Hoffman just looking at his watch, and he starts clicking off 45 and change. And, you know, 110 and change, he says, oh, my God. And he says, I hope he's not going too fast. He wanted to work in 7-4, 123 and change. And he came back, and Ian McKinley was the one who was working on his foot.
Sure.
Ian McKinley came back, and that horse's foot looked like it had been through a meat grinder. Mm. I mean, it was, how did that horse wound up getting to the Belmont Stakes? You know, he put a special shoe on there.
Yep.
How he made it to the Belmont and how he won the way he did, setting the pace and then dropping back to fourth and then coming on like a fresh horse. So as much as I love Silver Charm and, you know, would have loved to have seen him win the Triple Crown, or, you know, Baffert was at the height of his popularity. I mean, he was like a total rock star. But he really wasn't the best horse. I mean, Touch Gold, some people will never, ever know how great a horse Touch Gold was, because then he came back and he won the Haskell, and then they made a huge mistake running him at the Meadowlands on a horrible, horrible track, and he just like tore his foot apart, and then he ran him in the Breeders' Cup Classic, and I remember he came back the next morning, by the way, half of his foot was gone, and he was never the same horse. He just never was. Then he wound up having all kinds of physical problems after that, but I tell you, he was a good horse. But I mean, this Silver Charm was just a horse that everybody loved. You know, the horses you mentioned too about the anniversary, a horse that nobody talks of trying for the Triple Crown. How many people ever talk about Tim Tam? I mean, they never do. People have a tendency to forget. I mean, Tim Tam was, you know, he wins the Derby and the Preakness, and he goes into the Belmont, and he looks like a cinch for the Triple Crown, and he fractures his leg at the quarter pole.
Well, it's
and he still winds up finishing second to a really
charismatic
good horse, a stayer.
It's charismatic.
A bred horse named Cavan, and he wound up running second on three legs. Never ran again. I mean, he fractured his leg at the quarter pole. You can see where it happened.
Well, it's the charismatic. It's the charismatic story. But it's 1958 instead of 1999.
Yeah, well, the thing is, charismatic. You know, he got hurt like in this at the 16th pole.
True.
So you know, you don't know when it actually started, because when he took that bad step at the 16th pole, it looked like he might have been already beaten, but it's really hard to tell. But then, of course, you know, came the big incident after the race, where Antley pulled him up,
yeah,
and then just basically fell off of him on the ground and rolled over and picked the horse's leg up. And Bob Lewis came back afterwards and thanked him profusely for saving the horse. And Wayne Lucas never looked at it that way. Wayne Lucas never really forgave Chris Antley for not coming by to see the horse or whatever, but he held a lot of animosity towards him. Plus, I think he knew that, you know, Chris was having problems, and, you know, you could always tell looking at Chris that he was zoned out. But, you know, what he did was very dramatic, and
sure,
it's amazing that they were able to save that horse.
Steve, going to wrap up, but looking forward to what happened Saturday. Recap next week, and a final parting blow, because I do have Smoking Joe McKay, who brought me prime rib crab cakes, and I want to say hi to Joe. But what was your?
You had to tell me that.
I did, and I went to Michael's. We went to Michael's the other day from Timonium. We went across the street too.
Did you have their crab soup?
I actually, they had a short rib, they had like a short rib beef vegetable that the waitress, she was touting. So I went in that direction.
Oh, their crab soup is the best I've ever had. It is so packed with crabs and vegetables. Oh my God, I can just taste it now. I'm sure people are saying, yeah, of course he had to get into food. He couldn't leave without getting into food.
No, I had to give you a quick.
You brought it up, so.
Well, yeah, absolutely. we'll get you some. We'll send you some crab cakes. We'll get you some crab cakes.
Prime rib crab direction. Cakes. They're best.
Steve, I appreciate this fun hour, and enjoy. And we will we'll see where we stand about 7 o'clock Saturday night.
Enjoy the race. Where do you watch it from? Upstairs?
No, I'll probably be. In fact, I was trying to make arrangements for that yesterday. I will be in one of the infield buildings. Yeah, one of they don't do that international, which we used to have so much fun in.
Oh my God, was that great or what? Talk about great food, boy! do you remember what it was like, by the way, waiting for them to set up the buffet? Oh, they got the food already.
After coffee and Danish.
The food there was incredible, but that international pavilion, everybody wanted to get in there because the owners were in some big tent, open tent, everything, and it was hot. It was a hot day. It was this air-conditioned tent, you know, which is where they wound up holding the draw for several years. I don't know.
Well, they still are. They're still doing it.
They still do.
Yeah,
but you go out on that patio there, and you're like,
right.
You're like 20 yards from the finish line of on the grass course, and
exactly.
The winner's circle is right off to your right, and those days were great. With Lee Einsiedler. I mean, those were fantastic. Those were so much fun.
Well, there's still plenty of fun to be had, and looking forward, we're going to weather the storms, and we're going to enjoy it.
I see. I think it's like 30-40% now on Saturday. And,
oh, good.
You know, I mean, it'll still be sloppy, but it might not be too bad, actually, when the race is going off. So hopefully people are not going to get soaked.
Well, we're going forward no matter what. We're not turning back now.
Nobody, so,
right?
You're there. You're there. You might as well run the race.
Exactly. Steve Haskin, everybody, and a fun conversation hitting a little history and a little of the current action, and we're gonna tie it together. I got to get a quick hello in with Smoke and Joe McKay, who turn that around, Joe, other way. And we've got about 2 minutes. Zoe and Rich have had technical issues downstairs, and so we're going to bring Migliori and Cadman to you tomorrow. They promised, because I knew it would be impossible for them to get upstairs. But Joe came up, and I really appreciate it, Joe. Here, let me do that and shake hands.
All right, Steve.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I just had a great time at the
Alibi
breakfast with my buddy Brad Patton, who's got a horse in Saturday, the stake, daylight ahead with Hugh McMahon. So she's got a shot.
Absolutely.
She's got a shot. And Buzz Belair from the Prime Rib, he heard all the great promos from Steve Haskin, from you, and we got two to you. Since you weren't able to go to the Alibi breakfast, we got actually two to Bob Baffert, too. So he wanted to get some to Bob because, you know, Mike's is great, but then there's the Prime Rib. So Bob's actually going there tonight. So
I heard.
Yeah.
Blue was here.
Oh, but I know.
Blue was hanging out, and we had an hour with Blue.
I wish I could have had these things for Blue and you to share, and that would have been...
Well, it's Blue's recipe.
I know.
That's where Buzz got them. And
he's probably had enough of them.
Maybe. The guys in Saratoga, they laugh. John Nichols and all the guys that stay in the house up in Saratoga, because when Blue gets into the kitchen to make them, they find crab 3 weeks later, and it's all over the kitchen. It's everywhere. And there's crackers, the shells, exactly.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. John says he's lucky if he gets four crab cakes when it's all said and done, but the stuff's flying.
There's something about the blue crab to where you can go to France. When I was in France, I would show chef pictures of our Maryland blue crab, and they would stop in their tracks and go, "We wish we could get this here." And, you know, Rick Hammerly, I mean, Rick just, you know, I sent him the crab cakes, and he loves them. Yeah. So it's, you know, we do have the blue crab, so thank God for that.
My man, Dave Joseph here, Dave was pushing Papa's.
Pappas. Yeah, the
sports bar that he says it's got terrific crab cakes.
Other place I'd probably go to is called the Costas Brothers in Dundalk. Now in Dundalk they speak a different language. So. Yeah, I don't know. You might have to bring a translator.
and also the corner
yes.
Stable.
Corner Stable's the best.
Ribs,
anywhere
ribs and crab cake.
Ribs and crabs. Anywhere in Timonium. A little push maybe for tomorrow. Best yet, Robbie Bales. He's putting Ortiz on. Robbie Bales, he's the 12 horse in the sixth race. He can run in the slop, or he can run in the dirt. And he's from the dam, a Reuben sandwich. So we're going to end our food with the son of a Reuben sandwich tomorrow in the sixth.
Tomorrow in the sixth. And Bobby Bales, one of our favorites, going back to
Scrappy T.
BT.
Big price.
Absolutely. this has been...
This is the best.
This was a rollicking frolic.
It always is.
This one particularly, between Blue for an hour, and I said goodbye four different times, and then we went another 10 minutes each time, and we didn't even get to... I a couple people in the green room, Andrew Hawkins, Tom Quigley, Rich Ang.
How about Scheinman?
All over. Scheinman?
Oh, my God.
I haven't
God.
Even seen him.
He's here, he here somewhere, yeah.
He's so cute, you can put him in your pocket.
I know.
Let me pull up and send everybody out to the race day. 1:30, we start today with Carlisle Bell, the opener at Belmont, and want to wish safe trip. Angel Arroyo aboard, and looking forward to Bell in about 90 minutes. Off the turf here, obviously. Off the turf in New York. I'll thank Blue, Marty McGee, Steve Haskin, Smokin' Joe McKay, appearing at a club near you, and Tony Black. We're back tomorrow for weekend preview at the races. And if you missed anything, you missed a lot. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9 here on Sirius XM. You got HRRN coverage at 3 o'clock today for all the action. And looking forward to weekend preview. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
He's got a long way to go to come and get Army Mule, who's pulling away by 5.
2 years ago, Pennsylvania bred Army Mule was purchased at the Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic sale at Timonium. Now he's a Grade 1 winner.
Army Mule, ultra impressive in the Cartery Flew Home.
There'll be more than 30 Pennsylvania breds at the Fasig Tipton 2-year-olds in training sale, May 21st and 22nd at Timonium, Maryland. Breeding and racing in Pennsylvania, it's a winner.
While being on the cutting edge of scientific and nutritional research, Biomedical Research Labs has developed the number one selling equine blood builder in the world, the most advanced muscle builder and tie-up preventer, and now the best anti-bleeding paste ever made. To find out how EPO Equine, Unlock, and Bleeder Guard can help your equine athletes, contact me, Joseph Vellante, at 215-501-6880 and visit brlscience.com.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
Hi, this is retired race caller Tom Durkin. So, after this year's Derby, I stopped by Top Round Roast Beef on Shelbyville Road in St. Matthews. I got two sandwiches, one for back at the hotel and another for the trip back home to New York. The first one was so good, I had the other one right there. Certified Angus beef, roasted 5 hours, each one made to order. You can taste the difference. Top Round Roast Beef, Shelbyville Road, St. Matthews. Tell them Tom Durkin sent you. Oh, by the way, try the frozen custard too.